Welcome to Hour 2 of the program. The music indicates one thing specifically, and that is time for some fun. Time for some laughs. Time for Greg Wyshynski from ESPN MVSW Wednesdays here on the program. Hello, Wish. How are you?
Geez, no pressure. Fun and laughs.
Here we go. I mean, fun and
you're asking
laughs,
a lot.
And maybe we'll talk about some other fun stuff like aging curves and era adjustments and all those other types of fun things. Why don't we just start talking about Jack Eichel instead? Why don't we just start about Jack Eichel instead? So I know you're going to do a lot of this, I think, today, right? On ESPN, on The Point. I think you're going to be doing a lot of this. Oh, sorry, The Drop. I keep thinking Boomer. You can do a lot of this on The Drop.
Drop in Point tomorrow ahead of the actual return of Eichel.
So you're doing this today.
We've made a week out of it. I mean, Emily's okay. Got a chat with Eichel on the air now. All this coverage. It's really like, if you think about the gigantic player returns that we've had, this is clearly the biggest since Tavares, right?
Mm-hmm. You wonder if the reaction will be different, though. Like, Tavares was so soundly booed every time he came near the puck, even just when he touched the ice, whether it was warm-up or any of the three periods, he was getting soundly trashed. I don't know if that's going to be the case in Buffalo. The dynamic was certainly different. There were, like, it's never great when your franchise player asks for a trade and goes out the way that Eichel did, with acrimony between him and the general manager and, well, certainly the owner as well. And given what Buffalo Sabres fans have been through with their team, I'm guessing that more Buffalo Sabres fans, and again, we'll see tomorrow, will be a little more understanding of Eichel's predicament, unlike how the Islanders treated John Tavares. Agree to say.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a sense of more like a cheer for Eichel is a protest vote filed against the direction of the Sabres, right? Like, there's a certain aspect of that certainly wasn't inherent in the Tavares situation, where it was seen where he was abandoning a team that could have been every much the contender that the Leafs were in the eyes of many Islanders fans. I do, you know, a couple things here on Eichel. First of all, I do think that there is a strong contingent of people that feel that when you sign a contract, you are committed to a team, and because things haven't gone to your liking, you abandoning ship is essentially abandoning the city and abandoning the franchise. And I think there are also some people that, rightly or wrongly, don't believe that Eichel necessarily had the kind of impact in Buffalo that he should have had based on his lofty draft position. That being said, I was very interested to see the Buffalo Sabres part of this, because in my conversations with people, both fans and media in Buffalo in the week leading up to this, there was some real mystery as to how the Sabres themselves were going to handle the return. And so I got it from the team last night that there will be a video tribute to Eichel. It's not simply just going to be, let's put the camera on Eichel and have the fans do what they're going to do. They're making the effort to create content around the return of Jack Eichel, and I guess in some measure celebrate his time with the team, which again is very, very interesting when you think about the manner in which he left, that they would go ahead and still do that. So I was curious about that.
Well, we know that there was a lot of anger, and there's a lot of anger that went all the way to the top. And, like, things crumbled. Like, I still remember that. Man, do you ever see that video of the reality series the Buffalo Sabres were doing, where they go to Terry Pegula and say, like, hey, we think we can sign Taylor Hall? And Pegula says something to the effect of, well, if we're signing Taylor Hall, that means we're going for the cup. And everyone around him kind of says, yeah, and I can't believe anybody really believed that, but they said that to the owner. And from there to where it ended up a year later has to be a complete emotional roller coaster for the Pegulas. You see, a couple of the interesting things here for me is how fans treat players that ask for trades when situations change. And I look at it like, listen, man, teams trade players all the time. So I don't really buy the, well, you signed to be here, so you have to stay for the entire duration. But, you know, two people's signatures go on these contracts, and the team is, you know, can trade you, provided you don't have a no trade or no move clause. So I am legit curious how fans react to it, what the nature of the video is as well, what Eichel's response is going to be. Because, like, look, like, at the end of it, Jack Eichel thought he was going to have a long, healthy, productive, successful career for the Buffalo Sabres because, listen, Wish, when we were doing the pod, we kept talking about how they're doing, you know, Tim Murray's doing everything to make sure that this rebuild is done with a lot of high draft picks. And, you know, they were going to build it that way, and the whole thing was being done around Jack Eichel. It was not supposed to go the way that it went. But I'm curious, like, how Eichel feels about it. Sure, he went out with, you know, a lot of hard feelings towards your organization. I get that. I can't imagine how Eichel, like, do you ever think about how Eichel felt from day to day, you know, living with a neck that's deteriorating and how the team isn't moving you to a team that's going to allow you to have a neck surgery and significantly enhance your life the way that you choose? I always think about that. Like, what was going through Eichel's head every single day he wasn't able to get this surgery? Now,
I wonder if the thing that was going through his head was, boy, I wish the NHLPA was better at negotiating, because that's the reason you couldn't get the surgery wanted. They negotiated collectively to give the power to teams to dictate on matters of health to the players. And like most situations in this league where players are pissed off about something contractually or monetarily or by virtue of the cap, or, you know, they can't do something they want to do, there probably isn't enough introspection about what went on in those negotiations vis-a-vis their peers, versus abject anger at the team ownership for basically using the leverage that was given to them by the players.
I wonder, though, if now that it's been shown to be, and again, maybe we don't have enough time spent with this surgery with Eichel or Tyler Johnson, but now that players have done this, does this become more acceptable for other teams? And does it get to the point where, you know, the Players Association can file legitimate grievances based on, hey, this worked with Eichel, this worked with Tyler Johnson, you're not letting my guy in whichever market get this surgery, and now they have more of a leg to stand on against the teams? I'm guessing it would, but again, I don't know.
Yeah. I actually asked Eichel that, during his first press availability with the Golden Knights, about, you know, whether he kind of fancies himself a pioneer here, you know, like a leader on this front. He is, without question, fighting for what he believed in, fighting for the surgery that he wanted. Ryan Johnson gets it in the wake of Eichel getting it. And I think he truly believes, through his conversations with doctors and scientists and everyone else leading up to his own surgery, that this is the proper way to deal with these types of issues. And I think that there's a certain amount of pride that he takes in having fought as hard as he did to get it, because it means other players will. I wanted to pause on his contract for a second, because I find this to be fascinating. Okay. Not everybody has to sign an 8-year contract. Austin Matthews didn't. Like, he went shorter than that. Jack did, and McDavid did. And I remember, you know, a few years ago when there were starting to be the rumblings of, does Connor really want to have to do this for as long as his contract is going for? Does he want to constantly be in this space of, like, giving everything he has and coming to the precipice of winning Hart trophies, but only being undercut by the futility of the team around him? And my response usually is, well, he's got to be there. He signed a contract. It means he's committed to the franchise. He knew what he was signing. He knew what the team was. He knew the people behind the scenes. They'd change, but he knew what the kind of deal was. And for a long time, I was like that with Eichel too, in the sense of, like, when you commit to a franchise, you know what the franchise is. You could believe what you want to believe about its future and its potential success, but at the end of the day, you know what you're signing and you know where you're signing. But, like, when you get to that third rebuild during the duration of that contract, as Eichel did, right? Or, like, you know, during his time in Buffalo, when you get to that third rebuild, you kind of say to yourself, maybe there are certain situations here in which the commitment to the franchise has, that covenant's been violated by the franchise. Like, the number of times there's been stops and starts in Buffalo has been embarrassing. And Eichel was there for almost all of it. Yeah.
The once great economist Maynard Keynes once had a line when he flip-flopped on something. I cannot even recall what it was. It happened like a century ago. His justification was, well, when the circumstances change, I change my mind. What pray tell do you do? And the whole time that I'm thinking about Jack Eichel's situation with the Buffalo Sabres and, you know, them essentially telling him, yeah, we're going to go through a rebuild again, I can't help but thinking, if I'm Eichel, sure, I've signed long-term here, 8 years, but now the situation has changed. I signed for 8 years based on one assumption. Now that ground has shifted under me. I'm well within my rights to say, you know what? It's probably better you just use me to get some assets. It's probably best for everybody here. Like, I harbor no ill. Well, I wouldn't harbor any ill will if it were Connor. Or, hang on, let me take a quick detour with you on this one. You know what I keep wondering about?
Yeah.
As because you see it and you read it online, to your point about, oh, when is Connor going to get sour on the Oilers? And personally, I don't think he's close to that yet, if he ever will be. But you know who I do wonder about? Like, do you not wonder about Leon Draisaitl? Like, do you not see Leon Draisaitl at these press conferences as well? Like, if there was going to be, again, this is like major hypothetical here, right? Again, like the phrase getting radioed here, like, don't radio me on this one. Like, if there was like hypothetical, pick one, who would ask out first of a situation if it goes really south and the Oilers don't make the playoffs, Connor or Leon, who would you pick?
It's a great question.
We never focus on players in the game.
I still pick Connor.
You still do, eh?
Like, I still think Connor has the stroke to do it. And I still think that Connor knows who he is and knows what he's capable of. And you know, a lot of this is narrative, right? So let's think about what we know about Connor McDavid vis-a-vis the Edmonton Oilers. And when you think about that, what do you think of automatically? His face at the draft lottery, right? Like, you think about the fact that he didn't ask for any of this. You know, he was drafted, the Oilers won the lottery, they won the chance to draft him. We all remember what he looked like that night. And that's all been in the back of our mind forever, right? Like, rightly or wrongly, right? I mean, the guy signed a contract, he's obviously committed to the market, but that image will always be sort of there. In Leon's case, it's a very good question. I mean, we know the man to be, very confident. He knows himself. He probably is as voracious as someone who wants success as McDavid is. I mean, if I'm writing a Tumblr about this team mind, he's tired of being Scottie Pippen and wants out. He wants to go be his own star. Like, in my mind, that's the way it would work with Leon Draisaitl. But you're right, though. Like, as much as we're focused on McDavid being sick of this mediocrity, it could easily be Draisaitl at one point saying, I'm done with this too. And then being the one who puts his foot down.
Again, I don't know. I just raise it because I wonder about it. Like, whenever the question comes up about Connor, I always, because you need to look no further than the Oilers power play right now, where it seems as if all McDavid does is look for Draisaitl. Like, you know, the power play right now is killing the Edmonton Oilers. 5-on-5, they're playing fine. And their special teams is killing them every single night. And the power play just looks the same because Connor gets the puck and he looks for Leon. Like, that's, and everybody knows it. And so here come the sticks in the lane. And it's getting pretty simple to shut it down. Like, you don't need to be a sophisticated coach to understand. They just be like a local oaf like me watching from the couch. Like, you can see it. Like, he's looking for Leon and teams are just putting sticks there. But I just see Leon and Connor so attached here, but we're just focusing on the one and what he wants, and we're ignoring this other guy that wins our trophies as well,
right?
And say, like,
and scoring titles probably, and stuff.
And yeah, he's probably feeling the same way.
But if you're looking for a better encapsulation of how royally screwed the Oilers are, if I told you at the start of the season they're out of a playoff spot and the reason is because they can't score on the power play,
I know, right?
You would have been like, oh, what a disastrous year it must be for Edmonton. If, like, the one thing that is dependable about that team is right now one of the primary reasons they're not succeeding.
Okay, let's talk about goals. I know that, listen, that's a wild one too. And I think long-term Evan Bouchard becomes that guy on the power play. Cause the one thing they haven't had, they have Tyson Barrie as their main guy on the point for the power play. And he's not a shooting threat at all. Like, he just distribute the puck and that's cool. But I think when Evan Bouchard actualizes as a legit power play quarterback, this team is way better off because, I mean, just point blank, like, Bouchard's really good at getting the shot through. Like, we're well past the point of you have to have a McInnes, you know, type howitzer from the point. Just get it through. Bouchard can do that. And I think that's the thing that the Oilers need right now. Can they get pucks through? Because they don't have anyone to do it. So instead, Connor just looks for Leon for 2 minutes.
It's a, It's a subtle difference and something that a lot of people don't recognize when it comes to players running power plays. I mean, for example, Torrey Krug, right, in his first year in St. Louis, going from Pietrangelo to Krug was a bit of a difference for them, because essentially Krug's role in Boston was what? Get the puck to Pastrnak. Like, I mean, you're not having, I mean, Torrey Krug is adept at getting pucks through. I'm not saying that he isn't, but I mean, by no means is he the kind of shooting threat that the other players on that power play in Boston were. So you have your kind of distributors, and then you have your kind of point shot guys. And I think you're right that the Oilers are lacking that deep threat, for lack of a better term.
Goals. We're seeing a lot of them. Last night was boffo. I'm not sure how much hockey you watched last night, but whatever game or games wish you were watching had an average of 7.7 goals. Like 85 goals in 11 games last night. It was awesome. The Arizona Coyotes, that Jets Tampa game was ridiculous as well. The Hawks and the Anaheim Ducks. Like, big scores attached to these games here. My theory is a simple one, because I'm a simple man, Greg, and that is fatigue. Mm. Do you have any other ideas here? What could be a tribute? Like, again, it hasn't been a long time, so I don't know, but I'm guessing, like, by this time in the season, with all the games condensed and everything that everyone has gone through with COVID going in and coming out, I think everyone's just tired at this point. What do you think?
Kind of love that theory. Because earlier in the season, when this was happening, it was pretty easy to also blame COVID, because there were these major interruptions in the schedule and players you've never heard of tending goal for certain teams at different points of the season, which is never really a good sign when it comes to defensive acumen. So you had all of these sort of forces around the Omicron variant and the interruption in the season that I thought definitely contributed to the offensive uptick. And then things normalized and we're still getting 10-7 games. And so that's a really good theory as far as the fatigue goes. But I mean, it is also part of an overall trend that we've seen in the last five seasons of offensive uptick. You know, it ticked down last season. I think you could probably write that off as being anomalous, just like the fact that you had four divisions all siloed off from each other was anomalous. But before that, you had an increase in goals per game per team for three straight seasons, and then we have a gargantuan leap this season. To put this season in context right now, according to Hockey Reference, we've played 909 games. The average goals per game per team is 3.09. To put that in historical context, Merrick, that is a higher goals per game average than we had in the wackadoo 05-06 season, which is seen as like the greatest anomaly in recent
one.
NHL history. Right. Yeah, this would be the highest goals per game average for teams since the 95-96 season, the precipice of the trap era. So
have we measured the pucks? Are the pucks smaller? Do we know, Greg? Has anyone bothered to measure the pucks?
They have put flubber in the pucks, much like Major League Baseball did with the baseballs in the 1990s to get the fans back. They juice the pucks. The other thing too about this is the last two seasons have been the first time since 08-09 that average save percentage has dropped below .910. And in three of the last five seasons, power play efficiency has been over 20% on average. So there's a lot of things that are kind of consistent thematically to what's been happening in the league over the last 5 years, but we've just never seen a jump like that. And I think that fatigue could be the ultimate culprit here.
So there's a few things. So Elliot and I touched on this briefly in the first segment too, and Elliot brought up another one too. With all the games being condensed, there's less time for practice. Like, there's actually, like, there is less practice time and more time needed for rest. And like, you and I used to talk about this all the time. You know, what kills creativity in the NHL? Coaching. Right. And if the coaches can't get their hands on the players, what does the game look like? Maybe you can say, well, this is what the game looks like. I wonder how much of a factor that is too. Like, I don't think it's just one thing. I don't think it's just all the guys are tired. I think it's a whole bunch of things that are conflating here at the same time. I think it's the condensed schedule. I think it's fatigue. I think it's, you know, it feels like this season isn't ending anytime soon. Because it's not. It's a lot of hockey. I think emotional roller coasters that everyone has been onto, and I think it's just the guys don't have time to practice. And from a shooting point of view here, and I think this is where you're going to see this trend continue. I remember Alain Vigneault was asked about, you know, goaltenders and their equipment and should make the equipment smaller and nets bigger. And he said, listen, if guys want to score goals, they should work on their shot. And now more so than ever, you see players working on their skills in the offseason. Like, goalies would always spend the offseason working on being a goalie, and players would lift and just try to get their strength back. And that was it. But what do guys do now? They work on shots. Like, they all have skills coaches. They all work on offense. What was the old saying? For the longest time, you can't teach touch. And we all just believed it. We all just believe that, oh, you're born a goal scorer. Well, really? We've always said that, but is it true? No. And I think this era and this generation are proving that there's more than just, oh, you can't teach touch, because you can. I think that at the end of it too, like, everybody can shoot. Like, once upon a time in the NHL, there were like, what, three or four guys that could really shoot the puck wish? Now everybody can. Just go watch warm-up. Everybody can fire it.
All you need is a dented washing machine and a dream, right? And you can learn how to shoot. I think that's a really good point. And I think that we might be in an era right now where there's, you know, for years, the goalies and technique and defensive systems, I think, were ahead of the shooters. And I think that the quality of shots and the quality of shooters and the number of guys that are quality shooters has certainly spiked in the last decade. Now, one other thing I wanted to run by you, because it kind of ties into the Igor Shchurkin MVP argument, which is goalie work rate. And we've talked about before about the idea that, you know, there's voters for these awards that we chronicled earlier in the week on ESPN on NHL Awards Watch that are kind of looking at Shchurkin and saying, all right, this guy's playing 66% of his team's games. In the past, we've given the Hart Trophy to Theodore, Carey Price, to Hasek twice for playing upwards of 80% of their games. And the counter argument, and I think it's a good one, is that, well, those days are done. You know, we don't have many goalies now playing upwards of 70 games in a season. It's much more of a balance between starter and backup. It's just kind of the way that the league has gone. Now, if you wanted to track it back to around, let's say, 2015-16, I'm sure we had a lot of guys still playing 70 games at that point. You know, the save percentage has dropped on a league average basis every year since then. Save percentage has, it went from 915 in 15-16, 913, 912, 2 at 910, 2 at 908. There's a lot of factors inherent for that happening, but I wonder if part of it is that instead of having the best goalies in the league playing the preponderance of the games, because there's so much more balance, you are having B-level, C-level guys take more of the starts.
Yes. Because as much as, like, first of all, as much as we look at, you know, the previous era and all these guys getting their numbers retired and they're all in the Hall of Fame, you know, we went through a sort of golden age of defensemen with Pronger and, you know, Niedermeyer, Lidstrom. We also went through a golden age of goaltenders. And it was Brodeur, it was Hasek, it was Patrick Roy, it was Ed Belfour. I think right now, although we're starting to see more, I mean, How many goaltenders are there right now in the NHL that you would describe as elite?
Oh, that's a good question. Are we including Shchurkin in there? Does he have enough of a work history?
Yeah. I think Shchurkin is doing. I mean, the last time, let me give some more context to this for Shchurkin.
Oh, here we go. History lesson.
The best save percentage, well, it kind of is. So the best save percentage that we've seen in the NHL in going back to, like, the NHL started to keep save percentage in 1982-83, okay? But there was a guy by the name of Edward Ewan, who was just regular Joe hockey fan living in Regina, Saskatchewan, who decided to trace back save percentages to 1951, 52, or is it 52, 53? I can't recall. And what he came up with was the save percentage for Jacques Plante in 1970-71 was 944. Playing with the Toronto Maple Leafs. We all think of Jacques Plante, you know, the great goaltender, Montreal Canadiens. His name is spelled five different ways on the Stanley Cup. It's one of the great stories of the Stanley Cup. But his best season came with the Toronto Maple Leafs at a very advanced age as well. Now, there's a few things to that. Part of the deal that Jacques Plante had with the Maple Leafs that season was he got to choose the games that he played in at his advanced age. But still, it was a 944 save percentage, okay? Still, like, that's elite and stands to this day. Shesterkin's right there. Like, that's always been considered the gold standard of the save percentage season where one goalie gets to pick the games that he's playing in.
Right.
Shesterkin's right there with it.
Right,
like,
there.
Shesterkin's right around. What is he at? Was he at 942 right now or 943?
He's at 942. Yeah, 942.
So 942. He's right there up against Jacques Plante, who played the 40 games and got to choose his opponents.
Elite level goalies.
How many?
And I do kind of agree with you that we might be in that sort of era like the NBA had once Jordan left, like the valley between the Jordan era and the LeBron era, or maybe the Kobe era, like kind of a little bit of a lull as far as the elite players go. Shesterkin.
Yep.
Hellebuck. Vasilevskiy, without question. Now, do you put Markstrom in there, or is he a product of the Daryl Sutter system?
I do put Markstrom in there because that's not just the Calgary body work; that's the Vancouver body work. I put Jacob Markstrom in there.
So that's four. Do you put Freddie Anderson in there?
See, Elliot and I have had this conversation. You still want to see some playoff success, but right now he's having a heck of a season for the Carolina Hurricanes. But jury out on Freddie Anderson being elite.
Yeah, I think he's on the next level down. I think Sorokin's there too. I think
Where's John Gibson?
Demko's there too.
Where's John? Yep. Where's
John Gibson's a real tough one. That's a tough one for me, man. Like, I always feel like John Gibson and Darcy Kemper are of a piece for me in the sense that I feel like there were seasons in which they were so incredibly good on teams that were not, that it's been hard to really parse out when they've not been as good because their reputations sort of precede them, right? Like, I think both of those guys are in the same boat. I think I've always thought he's borderline. He's had some incredible seasons, but I've always thought he's borderline as far as that next tier to elite status. But where do you put him?
I love him, so I'll put him in the elite status, but I will hear conversations that he's on the bubble. But I'll put John Gibson in the elite. The one guy that I keep coming back to. Oh, it's even so hard to mention right now because we've seen him play at the elite level for a long time. We've also seen him completely collapse. So I don't know what to do with him, and that's Sergei Bobrovsky.
Yeah, you know, there was a moment this season when he certainly felt like he had climbed back to that level, right?
Yep.
And then there are also games this season where it doesn't feel that way. But how much of that is the noise created by a Florida Panthers team that doesn't seem all that interested in defending?
Although their blue line is really good. Like, they've got two players that are going to be in the conversation for the Norris Trophy and Aaron Ekblad and Mackenzie Weegar.
Yeah, and Gudas is back there, sure, but it takes more than defense to defend. the one name we didn't mention is Fleury. Where do you have him?
No, he's not at the anywhere close to the
He's not elite anymore?
Power. I don't think so. Okay. It's funny too because
that's fair enough.
He's off the vest in the last season, but he's not there. The other guy that I think you should include in the conversation is UC Saros of the Nashville Predators.
Oh yeah, of course.
All five foot eleven of them.
Oh my god, I saw him at the Stadium Series, man. I'm like, who let the soccer player in? he's got that Ryan Miller build where you see him outside the pads, you're like, what? I would put him on the elite level. I would put him on the elite level for sure.
But I think the point too, now that, you know, kind of Carey Price is you know, no longer in the game right now, I think we're looking at a league where, and this is, listen, Edmonton is feeling this pain, Toronto is feeling this pain. We keep talking about this goalie market. Go get a goalie that can help you. Who are these goalies that are gonna help teams? How many teams even have them? to begin with. And if you have one, there's no chance you're letting him go. It is the most precious commodity in the game right now.
Right. And even the teams that do have ones that aren't necessarily ones you don't want to let go are charging an arm and a leg for them, like Jonas Korpisalo and Martin Jones and players like that. Now, so, here's another thing about goalies that I find interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
Korpisalo, Columbus, I was told, wanted a second and a third.
Yeah, that's crazy.
You got to be kidding me. I know. Listen, trust me. I know. But you're right. Like, yes. Because, like, okay, no one's going to help out the Oilers here. So, okay, Ken, you need a goaltender? Great. We need a second and third round pick. Hello, Ken, you still there? Hello? Hello? Is this thing on?
How much of this thing that we're seeing in save percentage and goaltending is because we have a collection of young goaltenders that haven't hit their marks? Matt Murray, right? Mm-hmm. Carter Hart, Spencer Knight this season. Jordan Binnington, probably most famously. There's a lot of guys that should have ascended to the next level of, like, just below elite status in this league and haven't. Now, I don't know if that's a trend or if it always happens, and I'm just noticing it now because of the way that goaltending is in this league. But there certainly is a number of guys that you figured would be much higher in those tiers than they are right now, aren't they, Merrick?
Yeah, and where would you put Tristan Jarry of the Pittsburgh Penguins?
Boy, you talk about juries out. I mean, talk to me after game five of the series.
I know. Listen, Penguins should have won that opening round series against the Islanders last year. Sorry, Islanders fans, it's true. And that changed the fortunes for the season for the Pittsburgh Penguins, but nonetheless, there it is.
But as any Penguins fan will tell you, like, costing your team a playoff series is not necessarily portend that you're going to continue to do so. See also Marc-Andre Fleury. Like, there are ways to improve your game and be better and have better playoff series. So I read about Jarry recently for ESPN, and I think he's got some confidence behind him. I was shocked to find how much swagger he had, as was sort of indicative of that moment with Brad Marchand the other week that set off Marchand. Yeah, like that's a part of Jarry we don't normally get to see, and it's a part of that I want to see more of. Maybe it's the part that Ron Hextall saw and said, you know what, maybe this guy's okay. there's a certain vote of confidence that he's gotten from his GM. So he's not elite. He's not next tier below, but I mean, the way he's played this season. Look, there are two reasons, in my opinion, why the Pittsburgh Penguins have been able to maintain through all of these injuries and all this adversity of the season. The first is Mike Sullivan, and the second is Tristan Jarry.
Yep. And here's the other thing, too. I still, there's not a whole lot of noise around the Pittsburgh Penguins at this trade deadline, but I have a hard time believing that, knowing that Malkin could be gone, knowing that Rust could be gone, that Letang could be gone, this could be, you know, the last charge of this group. I have a hard time believing that they won't do something significant at trade deadline. Like, here's my logic. So I don't know about you, but when I saw the Jeff Carter extension, I said, okay, what does this tell us? And to me, that told me they expect one of or both Malkin and or Rust not to be coming back next year.
Interesting.
Because they signed Carter to the 2-year extension at 36 years old. Like, okay, so if that's the case and they don't expect them back, knowing what Crosby means to the organization, what Crosby's done for the organization, where the team is at right now, I have a hard time believing that Ron Hextall and Brian Burke don't give this team one more shot at it. Because don't forget, when they took over, when Hextall and Burke took over, it was, okay, we're gonna see what we have here, and then we're going to start to make our moves. And things turned around. And then the competitive juices get going. And then they play that series against the Islanders, which was a heartbreaker for the Pittsburgh Penguins. They probably should have won it, but they're like, okay, all we needed was a save. We're still right there. And they go into this season with questions about Malkin and Rust and Letang, etc. And they find themselves in one of the best spots in the NHL. I have a hard time believing that they're going to look at this and not say, all right, you know what? Burn the ships. One more shot at it. We know all about draft capital and cupboards are bare and all that, but we owe it to this team. We owe it to that guy, and we owe it to these fans to give them one more shot at this thing. I think Pittsburgh is one of the more intriguing teams at deadline because of it. And to me, it's because of the Carter deal. The minute I saw the Carter deal, I said, they think one of the two aren't coming back, or maybe both.
It's an interesting take. I want to agree with you that they're going to be a team that makes a splash. But the problem is it has to be money in, money out. They don't have the flexibility to do anything
which
beyond.
Is why I believe this is where a team like either the Buffalo Sabres or the Seattle Kraken get involved to hold money in a deal. Now you're going to have to send something their way to facilitate a trade, but you can do it.
Oh, you can definitely do it. And I'm not saying that you couldn't make it work with someone picking up a portion of the cap hit, but I mean, like, even at that level, they don't have the cap space. They're going to have to ship out salary to make it happen. That doesn't mean they can't. It doesn't mean they can't make the numbers work, but I think they're just very limited in the amount of money they can take on.
So to me, it's the Penguins. Do you have one team in your mind that you look at? Because listen, we've heard tons about the Panthers. We've heard tons about the Blues, a lot about the Avalanche, Carolina Hurricanes as well are in on every big deal. Is there a stealth team out there for you at deadline? For me, it's the Penguins. Do you have one?
Well, the stealth team would be the Kings, because I think we're inching closer to what I call the Dean Lombardi point, in which you have to determine what you want to do with your prospects. And you have a lot of veterans that are playing really well. The underlying numbers for the Kings are really good this season. I think they're a playoff team. And I'm intrigued to see, after a few years now of evaluation, now granted it's been interrupted by COVID and things like that, but if after a few years of evaluation, who do they believe in? Who do they cut bait? Who are the ones that become their Braden Chens and their Wayne Simmonses, you know, that they move to bring in your Jeff Carters and your Mike Richardses? You know, like, I'm interested to see what the Kings have and whether they're going to continue with the build that they have with what has been considered by some to be the best farm system in the league in some seasons recently, or if it's time to start flipping out prospects and upgrading in certain positions, particularly with someone like Jacob Chychrun. The team I'm fascinated by is Florida. They're insane. Like, they're clearly going to make some gigantic trades at the trade deadline, because like there's a beautiful mad scientist aspect to Bill Zito, and it's not, maybe mad scientist isn't the right term, because he's not mad. Like there's a method to that madness. They've done a really good job identifying players and adding them to their group and building out an amazing depth at forward. They've done a really good job there, but like they're so aggressive. I find it hard to believe that they're not going to be one of the teams. You know, I know you've talked about it before, being in the Claude Giroux sweepstakes and things like that. I can't imagine they're not going to be one of the teams that makes the loudest bang at the trade deadline, just because that's what they do.
It looks like they're in on a forward, and if it's going to be a forward, it'll be a biggie. And it looks like they're in. Like, I still think at the end of all of this, they're the ones that end up with Jacob Chychrun. I still do. Like, I look at, you know, I look at Spencer Knight, Owen Tippett, first round pick, done. Like, does that feel like that gets it done for you?
For Chychrun? Well, it depends on how the Coyotes feel about. Yeah, it depends on how the Coyotes feel about not only Spencer Knight, but how Bill Armstrong feels about goalie development and what Knight becomes and what Knight could become, and whether or not it's worth dabbling in that or developing your own guy within your own system. So I'm intrigued by that.
They essentially want three first-round picks, and that does it.
Right, which is essentially what they get. Now, the thing about Chychrun to the Panthers that I think is important is – part of the DNA for championship teams in this league has been the ability to have two stud defensemen. You know, whether you're talking about Hedman and McDonough, you know, what the Knights have tried to do with Petrangelo and Theodore, or the Theodore, Theodore, thinking about the Hart Trophy.
Again. Abs goalie.
And now if you roll out the Ekblad pairing and then have Chychrun behind them, and Chychrun becomes Chychrun again,
or,
I've really got
no. All of a sudden, No, listen, all of a sudden, what you do is you roll out Aaron Ekblad with Jacob Tricker, and that moves Mackenzie Weegar down to play on the right side along with Gustav Forsling, and then all of a sudden that becomes your top four. Radko Gudas all of a sudden goes down to your third pairing. And then how does your defense look? Like, it lines up so good. It lines up so good.
Maybe you've broken something that don't need fixing if you break up Weegar and Ekblad. I mean,
well, here's the thing. Like, I wonder. So here's the thing. I worry about that if I'm Calgary. Like, right now, you get the feeling like Brad Treliving wants to make one more move, but is really sensitive about touching anything on this team. I don't know that Bill Zito has that same sensitivity.
No, but I mean, in particular with that pairing, I wouldn't mess with it.
Ekblad and Weegar.
Yeah,
you wouldn't touch it. I don't know, man. It'd be pretty tempting to put Ekblad and Chickard together and then move Mackenzie Weegar down to his natural side.
That's your McDonough and Girardi at the height of their powers. Like, you know, you just don't touch that. You don't need to. You're fine. Or Keith and Seabrook.
It's your Anderson Hannafin to bring it up to modern times right now. speaking of time, we are heavy on it. And by the way, I think you're bang on about the Los Angeles Kings. I think whether it's Turcotte or Kapari or Thomas or a lot of Vilardi, like I wondered about some of the moves that Rob Blake made in the offseason. And I kind of said, what does that say about where they think their prospects are at? And are they looking at moving them and turning them into bodies? I'm with you on that one. Okay, there you go. So from our conversation about Jack Eichel to an in-depth discussion about what to do with Mackenzie Weegar, another Wednesday edition has come and gone. Thank you, my friend. You be well. Say hello to Arto Cal for me, please.
I certainly shall. And the drop is at 6:30 tomorrow night on all ESPN streaming platforms. Do check it out. Rick Jenneret, sir, will be on the show along with Hillary Knight. So it should be a fun one.
RJ and Hillary Knight be part of the Canada versus U.S. rematch on Saturday in Pittsburgh under the banner of the PWHPA. Thanks, Wes. You be good.
Thank you, Merrick.